This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Tricks for Free, Encrypted Book 7. Written by Seanan McGuire, performed by Emily Bauer.
Payment. Noun. 1. The act of paying for something. Reward or punishment. Penance. Noun. 1. Punishment for past actions. 2. An attempt to pay for what can't be bought. 3. See also, exile. Prologue. Woe betide the damned soul who tries to get between me and my children. I'm only the nice one in this family, because I don't care enough to hurt you. Evelyn Baker. The locker room of Lewis and Clark High School, Portland, Oregon. 6 years ago. Cheerleaders filled the room. Most were half-clad. All were getting dressed with the ruthless speed and lack of artifice universal to teenage girls with no one they needed to put on a show for. The show would come later, when the Trailblazers football team took the field with their loyal spirit squad behind them, waving their pom-poms and cheering for victory. A new girl rushed into the room, forcing the others to make room or get knocked over. Her game bag was slung over her shoulder, and her auburn hair was pulled into a sloppy ponytail, tied off with a wilted spirit ribbon in Trailblazers blue and gold. A freshman girl straightened from her crouch too slowly. The newcomer placed a hand between her shoulders and used her as an impromptu vault, landing on the other side of her without breaking stride. A diminutive peroxide blonde with the figure of a Tolkien elf and the presence of a pop star dropped her mascara wand and turned away from the mirror, planting her hands on her hips in a classic superhero pose. "Melody West," she snapped, voice a whip cracking through the room. "You are late." The new arrival stumbled to a halt, momentum lost in the face of her captain's disapproval. She turned, spirit bow somehow looking even more wilted. "I'm sorry, Sophie," she said. "My family..."
"Sorry doesn't stack our pyramid when you don't show up, Mel," said Sophie.
Then she stopped, eyes going wide.
"Wait, are you bleeding?"
Melody West, better known in some circles as Antimony Price, youngest daughter of the Price family and cryptozoologist in training, barely managed to conceal her wince. She'd been hoping to get to her locker and her emergency first aid kit before anyone noticed that her lip was split and her knees were skinned severely enough to impress a 6-year-old.
"You should see the other guy," she said weakly.
Sophie lowered her arms and moved toward her teammate, irritation forgotten. The other cheerleaders clustered around them as Sophie seized Antimony's hands. Antimony swallowed another wince. Sophie clearly hadn't noticed that her palms were almost as raw as her knees. "Who did this to you?" Sophie asked, voice low. A murmur of angry curiosity rose from the rest of the squad, formless and violent. Melody was one of their own. Melody was part of the team.
If they needed to no-show on the game to kick somebody's ass on her behalf, well, that was a price they were willing to pay to protect a fellow trailblazer.
Antimony dropped her eyes, looking to the side and away. It was a practiced motion, and one she'd been using when people asked her about her frequent injuries since the start of high school.
Wasn't fair. Her older sister, Verity, got the skill with makeup to conceal her bruises and scrapes without looking like she was enrolling in clown school. And Alex, her older brother, was a boy. People generally shrugged off anything less severe than a broken bone as long as he looked stoic about it. She was pretty sure that wasn't fair either. Alex had as much right to concern and compassion as she did, and being a boy didn't mean his injuries hurt any less. But he didn't complain because a bruise ignored was a bruise not reported to social services. Under the circumstances, she would have swapped with him in a hot second.
"Mel, you've got to talk to someone."
"If this is your loser boyfriend?"
There was no loser boyfriend. There had never been a loser boyfriend. Antimony had fabricated him from whole cloth, a rough,
slightly disreputable character who went to a different high school and had been portrayed, on the few occasions when he needed to be seen by her classmates from a safe distance, by her nerdy cousin Artie, in what he insisted on calling Jacques Cosplay, driving her Uncle Ted's 1969 Camaro and sneering. Thus far, she'd managed to keep any member of the squad from meeting him face to face, which was for the best since Artie's pheromones tended to scramble the hormones of girls he wasn't actually related to. "I'm fine," she said. And that was the truth, at least. All her wounds were the kind that could be handled with band-aids and antiseptic and extra foundation. The changeling-infested bear she'd helped her family kill couldn't say the same. It was dead and downed and probably on fire by now, since her mother had very firm ideas about disposing of hazardous material. If she was being really honest, she was feeling a little smug. How many people could fight a murderous, technically undead bear and make it to campus in time for the big game? Not many. That was how many. She was crushing it. Sophie sighed. "Okay, we don't have time to argue about this right now, but will you promise me you'll at least think about talking to someone? I'm scared for you." "I promise," lied Antimony, without a twinge of guilt. She'd been lying to her friends and teammates since kindergarten. What was one more? "Thank you," said Sophie, and pulled her into a quick hug before turning to the rest of the squad and barking, "Anyone who's ready to hit the field, get your butt over here and get malpresentable. What looks bad on one of us looks bad on all of us." Like a glittering cloud, the cheerleaders descended. If there had ever been a triage team as efficient as cheerleaders helping one of their own get ready, Antimony couldn't think of it. In a matter of seconds, she was sitting on a bench, stripped from the waist down. One cheerleader bandaged her knees. Another covered the gauze in trailblazer blue athletic tape, making it look more aesthetic than accident. Two more cheerleaders dealt with the damage on her face, expertly layering paint and powder. "Arms up," commanded Sophie. Antimony put her arms up. The makeup team paused long enough for Antimony's sweater and bra to be removed. Antimony spared a momentary thanks for the fact that she'd been through this process before and had no difficult-to-explain weapons concealed on her person. "Arms out!" Antimony stuck her arms out. Sophie produced Antimony's sports bra and uniform top from the gym bag, pulling them onto the larger cheerleader's body. Someone hit Antimony in the face with a fistful of glitter. She struggled not to cough. It might have thrown off the person who was brushing her hair. Then, someone else was taping her hands, and her skirt was being fastened around her waist. And she was done. She was dressed. "Good work," shouted Sophie, clapping her hands and glancing at the clock above the door. "With 2 minutes to spare, go Trailblazers! Go Trailblazers!" shouted the rest of them, even Antimony, who wasn't really Antimony anymore. She was Melody West, high school cheerleader, without a care more complex than finally landing that perfect tumbling pass and seeing the world spread out before her in perfect, crystalline simplicity. They moved as one, out of the locker room and across the grass to the glowing rectangle of the football field. The sun was long down, and floodlights lit the bleachers and the green, making it look like a slice of paradise, like something too perfect to be real. There was a cut between the sections of the stands, and the squad ran through it just as the announcer boomed, "Your Trailblazer Cheer Squad!" Everyone in the bleachers cheered and shouted and waved their pennants and foam fingers in the air. It wasn't because they loved cheerleaders so much, Antimony knew. It was because the football teams would be out next, and then the game would finally start. That didn't slow any of them down. The squad broke into a new formation, the flyers going into an elaborate tumbling pass, the bases hitting their poses and waving their pom-poms high. Antimony hit her mark and froze. It wasn't safe for any of them to go to the same school. She and her siblings had all been educated separately, using their education as an opportunity to test out their false identities and learn to blend. She'd never set foot on any of Verity's high school campuses. She'd had three, overachiever that she was, and had only seen Alex's school once, after he'd graduated, when an away game had taken her to their football field. Family didn't come to school. That was their rule. That was how they kept things distinct and prevented future disaster. And there, sitting in the front row, dressed in school colors and clutching school pennants and looking for all the world like students who'd decided to come and see what all the fuss was about, were her dead aunts, Mary and Rose. Rose was wearing a letter jacket, which explained the hot dog in her free hand. As a hitchhiking ghost, she could become temporarily alive again if she borrowed someone else's clothes, and she was always, always hungry. Mary just looked like, well, Mary. White hair blowing in the breeze, one fist thrust into the air. Finally, her family had come to see her cheer. Grinning ear to ear, Antimony shook her pom-poms and chanted, "Do your best to blaze that trail! You know our team never fails!" The other team's cheerleaders answered, and the crowds roared, and the football players took the field, and everything was perfect. Everything was finally, absolutely perfect. Antimony never wanted the night to end, but of course, it did. Chapter 1. Change is good. Change keeps us growing, and growing keeps us living. But don't ever change so much that you forget who you used to be. Frances Brown. The cast member recruitment office of Lowry Entertainment, Inc., Lakeland, Florida. 8 months ago. I sat very straight in my uncomfortable plastic chair, trying to look like I wasn't freaking out. Judging by the way the other applicants kept glancing at me, I wasn't doing a very good job. Let's see any of them stay this calm after spending 4 nights sleeping in the snake-filled bushes next to the Florida highway, waiting to be eaten by the next available alligator, wondering if that might be an improvement over waking up in the morning and resuming their walk. I hadn't eaten in 2 days. The only reason I didn't smell like a dumpster fire was the truck stop half a mile outside of town, which had attached showers available for rent. My last $5 had gone for hot water and industrial soap and the prayer of getting this job. There were other jobs. Some of them might be easier to get, especially given my current circumstances, and if I had to resort to them, I would. There's no shame in flipping burgers or cutting lawns. But I wanted the anonymity of the crowd, the knowledge that my itchy polyester uniform made me part of a faceless mob. If the Covenant was looking for me, they'd be checking the greasy spoons and car washes. Those are the places people on the run are supposed to go to make a quick buck. This was a whole different league, and I was counting on that to protect me. If I could get through the door. I'd burned most of my fake IDs when I ran away from the carnival. My cousin Artie tracks them for us, making sure the associated credit cards and address information will always ping as valid on government systems. The trouble there was that my cousin Artie tracks them for us. If I used any of those identities, he'd be able to find me, and that would completely undercut the point of running away. But I still had one to fall back on. Artie didn't create Melody West, because he'd been too young when I first needed her. She'd been a gift to my parents from Uncle Al, a jink living in Las Vegas who got adopted into the family through the usual complex series of unreasonable events. We don't have much blood family left in the world, but we make up for it by acquiring honorary family everywhere we go. As far as most people are concerned, Melody West disappeared after she graduated from high school. One more boring mystery for a world that's always been absolutely full of them. I've never liked to let anything useful go to waste. I'd been expanding upon and tinkering with her identity ever since, keeping her on the grid just enough to qualify as a real person. She'd never held a steady job, never anything lucrative enough to attract the attention of the IRS, but she'd never applied for benefits either. She moved around a lot. She was unremarkable, unnoticeable, and she was mine. No one else knew her ID was still active. Antimony Price couldn't get a job at Lowryland because Antimony Price wasn't here. Melody West, though, just might stand a chance. Melody? The woman who called my name didn't look up from her clipboard. I rose. Here. She finally glanced up. Her nostrils flared in barely smothered dismay at the sight of me. There's only so much a truck stop bathroom can do for a body. I'll give her this much. She covered her reaction quickly. This way, she said, stepping back into the hall. People had been vanishing through that door all morning long. None of them had come back. There was another door that led to the outside, to keep those of us still waiting from either getting dispirited when we saw happy applicants, or cocky when we saw disappointed ones. Psychologically speaking, it was probably a good design. In practice, it made me feel like everyone who left was being fed into a giant meat grinder somewhere behind the scenes. And now, it was my turn. I forced myself to keep smiling and followed the nameless woman out of the room toward what I hoped would be my future. Children and parents all over the world speak the name of Michael Lowry with only slightly less reverence than the name Walt Disney. They were rivals once, after all, and while Disney proved to have the edge when it came to modern family entertainment, Lowry held his market share with an iron hand, producing innovative pictures and inexpensive alternatives for the family that couldn't quite afford the golden spires of Disney's Enchanted Kingdoms. Not managing to match Disney's towering successes didn't take him out of the game. Like Disney, Lowry dreamed of amusement parks, immersive environments for the whole family to enjoy. Like Disney, Lowry saw California and Florida as the best locations to realize his dreams, since they were the states with the mildest winters and hence the fewest annual closure dates. They weren't the only ones to flee to America's vacation destinations, but they were the first to break ground on their great entertainments, and Florida's Lowryland opened only 2 years after Disney World. Not that anyone would have known Disney World even existed from walking down the hall of the Lowryland recruitment office. Framed black and white photos of Lowryland were placed every few feet, each tastefully accentuated with a plaque or framed award certificate or article extolling the superior virtues of Lowry Entertainment, Inc. over all other children's entertainment companies. I'd been expecting team spirit from the Lowry folks. No point in being on a team if you can't find something to cheer about. But this was approaching pep rally levels. My escort led us to a cubicle maze, where she gestured for me to take a seat on the petitioner's side of an L-shaped desk. She wrinkled her nose, ever so slightly, when my butt hit the chair. I was clearly even dirtier looking than I'd thought. My heart sank. I could try Lowry again, of course. The nice thing about having a fake ID is that you can always get another one. But fake IDs cost money, and without contacting my family, I'd have to find a way to get that money on my own. Robbing convenience stores might play a big part in my future if I wanted to be able to buy clean clothes, a clean name, and a second shot at all the jobs I was about to not get. All right, Miss West, what brings you to the Lowry family? Why should we consider you for the position? I'm a hard worker. I'm motivated to meet and exceed any employment requirements, and I have experience working with traveling carnivals, which means I've worked with crowds, children, people experiencing ride-related vertigo, and entertainers. All of that was true. That's the key to a good lie. Build it on a foundation of as much truth as possible, because the truth will shore it up even when the falsehoods begin falling away. I'm getting awfully tired of lying about who I am. There's always been a veil of pretense between me and the rest of the world, thanks to my family and what we do, but there's a big difference between basic subterfuge and this Bruce Banner on the run from government goons bullshit that has consumed my life. The woman flashed me a frozen smile. My heart sank. That wasn't the sort of smile that came before you got the job. It might be the kind of smile that came before security is going to escort you off the premises. All in all, not a good sign. My fingertips grew hot as my anxiety about failing to get the job translated into adrenaline, and the adrenaline translated, as it so often does,
into my body, trying to involuntarily set things on fire. Being an untrained magic user in the process of manifesting her powers is fun. And by fun, I mean only slightly better than being covered in wasps, like, all the goddamn time. Better yet, there's no one around to train me. The last magic user in our family was my grandfather, Thomas Price, and he's been missing since long before I was born. My Aunt Mary could get me the lessons I need, but she's a crossroads ghost, and, well, some prices are still too steep for me to pay, even if it means occasionally charring my clothes. I stuck my fingers under my knees, smothering them as best I could, and met the woman's frozen smile with a weak, wavering smile of my own. "Please don't say what you're about to say," I thought. "Please don't." She did. Lowryland is not a traveling carnival, Miss West, and while we appreciate your enthusiasm, your lack of either references or a fixed address makes you... Melody? Excitement tinged my assumed name, causing it to climb higher with every letter, until it peaked in something just shy of a squeak. Melody West? The woman with the clipboard blanched. I turned. There, standing in the mouth of the cubicle, was my high school cheer captain, Sophie Vargas. Oh, she was older now, who wasn't, and had traded her cheerleading uniform for a smart pantsuit in a shade of cream that set off her naturally tan skin gorgeously. It looked like it cost about as much as my cousin Elsie's car, and that wasn't even going into the accessories, which were all opal and obviously all real. Her makeup was tasteful, her heels were both leather and low, and I could easily have walked past her on the street without a second glance, if not for one little detail. She had a spirit bow in the Lowry Entertainment logo colors, red and silver, clipped above her left ear. It was a playful, almost juvenile affectation, and it made the rest of her make sense. Sophie was always an overachiever. Now, she was just overachieving on a corporate level. I didn't have to work to make my eyes widen or my jaw drop. The sight of her did that all on its own. Sophie? Oh my God! I heard your voice down the hall and I thought, nah, that can't be Mel's! But here you are! Sophie paused, frowning. Here you are. Clarice, what are you doing here? If this is an intake interview, it should be happening in one of the conference rooms. Miss West's credentials are somewhat lacking, said the clipboard woman. She was less frightening now that she had a name and was grimacing like she'd bitten into something sour. She does not have a fixed address, and while she's listed several relevant skills, she has no verifiable past employment. I see, said Sophie. There was a sudden, venomous sweetness in her tone. I remembered that voice aimed at cheer newbies on the field behind our high school, usually right after they complained about something trivial. Did you not receive this quarter's memo on giving back to the community by working with people who lack work history but possess applicable skills? That was meant to help us hire more seasonal college workers, not homeless people, said Clarice. Sophie's face froze. I see. Thank you for your candor. I'll be speaking with your supervisor. Melody, with me, please. It had never been a good idea to argue with Sophie when she used that tone. I couldn't imagine that had changed. I jumped to my feet, grabbing my backpack from where I'd stuffed it under the chair, and started toward the cubicle exit. At the last moment, I paused, offered Clarice a wan smile, and said, "Thank you for meeting with me." Sophie took my arm and whisked me down the hall before Clarice could reply. That might have been for the best. I couldn't imagine whatever Clarice might have had to say would be terribly complimentary. The cubicle maze extended to the far wall, where Sophie took a sharp left, pulling me into a narrow hallway with walls only a few shades darker than her suit. I made a sound of impressed amazement as I realized her outfit was not only designed to coordinate with her accessories and her coloration, but with the building itself. She was dressed to look like the whole place had been painted solely to flatter her. It was either genius or proof that she'd spent too much time as a cheerleader, or possibly both.
Both was always an option. We reached an open door with her name on a brass nameplate next to it. Sophie Vargas Jackson. I blinked. You got married? I would have invited you, but no one knew where you were. Sophie gave me a measuring sidelong look. It was the first time she'd visibly assessed me since stepping into Clarice's cubicle. It definitely wasn't the first time she'd done it. Sophie was good like that. People never knew she was sizing them up until it was done. You know, most of the old squad has stayed in touch. You're the only one who dropped off the face of the planet. Yeah, well, I looked away before she could see more than regret in my eyes. Things got complicated. Things always do. Sophie's office was sleek, sophisticated, with leather chairs and glass-topped furnishings, all accented with little pops of Lowry red. Literally, Lowry red. That's the name of the color. Isn't trademark law fun? She stepped around the desk and sat in her high-backed executive chair, gesturing for me to have a seat. I sat. The visitor's chair here was sure a lot nicer than the one in Clarice's cubicle. It was probably going to need to be steam-cleaned after encountering me. "Did you marry him?" asked Sophie without preamble. I blinked at her. Because I've been the hiring manager here for 2 years. Don't laugh. I'm young, but I went to business school and the company knows potential when it comes along. I've seen a lot of people come through those doors and run into the gatekeepers like Clarice. She's supposed to screen out the ones who aren't safe to be around children, the ones who aren't competent. Clearly, it's time to send her back to sensitivity training. Sophie rolled her eyes. Some people can't get it through their damned thick skulls that if you're willing to see the potential in everyone, you're in a position to benefit from everyone. You'll never find a harder, more dedicated, more loyal worker than someone who's already been passed over by somebody else. You're running a corporation like a cheer squad? Sophie had become squad captain when we were sophomores in high school, winning by a clear majority vote on a platform of inclusiveness and not being a jerk without good reason. She didn't quite have an everybody into the pool policy, but under her guidance, our squad had become a lot more diverse and a lot more successful than it had been under the previous regime's "we like skinny blondes who don't make good bases, but sure can shake their asses" guidelines. Sophie smiled thinly. I'm not running the corporation yet. Give me 10 years and maybe I will be. Did you marry him? Because I'll be honest, I assumed you'd said no when he asked, and that he'd murdered you and stuffed your body into a drainage ditch somewhere. It's not like your absentee parents would ever have noticed. Just like that, everything clicked. Melody West did not come from a warm and loving home, because if she had, I wouldn't have spent all my time making excuses for the absence of her, of my parents. My home was warm. My home was loving. It was just that my parents couldn't come to my school functions any more than they'd come to Verity's or Alex's. But we were as close to on our own as the system allowed. But that meant people looked at my naturally somewhat dour demeanor and frequent bruises and assumed I was neglected at best, abused at worst. I didn't work very hard to convince them otherwise. If they thought they had all the answers, I didn't look any deeper. Unfortunately, it also meant that when my squad decided I was dating a boy who beat me, they didn't trust my parents to step in and stop it before I got seriously hurt. My high school career had been peppered with well-meaning interventions aimed at ending a relationship that didn't exist. When Melody West vanished after graduation, it was easy to understand why they'd drawn the conclusions they had. And I felt terrible for doing that to them. Not so terrible that I wouldn't take advantage now that I needed it. I cast my eyes down at my hands, clasping them together in my lap and mumbled, "I didn't get murdered." "Where is he now?" I shrugged. Sophie sighed, relieved. "Mel, did you finally leave him?" I glanced up, reading her expression quickly before I said, "I was in a bad spot. I couldn't stay, so I ran with what I had on me. The money ran out a couple of days ago. I know I look like hell, but I can work. You know what kind of work ethic I have, and I thought,
I thought I might feel better if I went to work someplace that's about making people happy. I thought it might make me happy, too. All of it was true, except for the last part. Working at Lowryland wasn't going to make me happy. It was going to make me harder to find. It was going to buy me the time to figure out what to do next. I needed to disappear before the Covenant used me to find my family. Sophie nodded. I can't do you any special favors just because we have a history. I know, I didn't expect to find you here. But I can do you the favor Michael Lowry wanted us to do for the entire world. I can give you a chance. Sophie leaned across the desk. Do you really want a job? I do. Then, welcome to Lowryland, she said, and held out her hand. And welcome back to your life. I took her hand and shook it and smiled. Things were finally going my way. Chapter 2. If you live a lie too long, it turns into the truth. Be careful which ones you decide deserve that kind of power. Enid Healy. A shitty company apartment 5 miles outside of Lakeland, Florida. Now. My alarm went off before sunrise, shrieking shrill and piercing in the gloom of my bedroom. Only gloom, not darkness. Both my roommates were already up, and while they were generously keeping their voices down until I crawled out of bed, neither of them could see in the dark. The hallway light crept around the edges of my door, painting everything in shades of charcoal. I rolled onto my side and hit the alarm clock with all the pent-up aggression I'd collected over the past few days. It stopped shrieking. It did not, alas, break. Like all Lowryland cast member housing, capital letters mandatory unless you wanted an official Lowryland branding lecture, our apartment came equipped with ancient, industrial-strength alarm clocks designed to wake the dead if necessary. If you could break one, you'd be fined $20 and issued a replacement that had been made less than 10 years ago, which meant it could take an iPod hookup and wake you with something less violent than the screeching of a nuclear air raid siren. As to why we didn't just replace them, spot inspections were a thing that happened because, apparently, we couldn't be trusted to not destroy company property. If one of the managers swung by and found us with an unauthorized alarm clock, we could be fined a lot more than $20. We'd also get a black mark on our records. All 3 of our records, even if only one of us had gone to Target for modern technology. Much as we hated the alarms, we hated black marks on our record even more. My name is Antimony Price, even if no one calls me that anymore. And sometime in the last 8 months, this became my life. I worry about alarm clocks now. I worry about black marks on my record. I worry about getting out of bed on time. Groaning, I sat up and rubbed my eyes with the heels of my hands, trying to make them want to open. I did not. Opening was, in fact, low on their list of things to do today, right above staying open and looking at the world. I respected their right to protest, but had to declare a fiat, since they didn't really have a choice. I needed to work if I wanted to eat, and I needed to eat if I wanted to stay alive. For all that things had turned to shit since leaving the carnival, I wasn't ready to lay down and die. Not yet. Not until I knew whether I'd managed to save my family by running when I did. Most people have seen the footage, either live or on YouTube. A blonde girl in high heels and a sequined dress fighting a giant monster snake on national television, right before declaring war on a shadow organization, shooting the camera and disappearing. Oh, heads almost certainly rolled over that. Someone should have killed the feed before it hit the air. The network did kill the feed for all time zones after the first one, but we live in the age of instant gratification. Uploads and downloads and viral videos, and once the cat, once the giant dimension-hopping snake, was out of the bag, there was no putting it back. The world was watching. That wasn't me. That was my big sister, Verity. She of the awesome dance moves and totally absent common sense.
We're in hiding from a global organization of monster hunters who think we're public enemy number one, she thought. I'll just go fight a snake cult on national television. To be fair to her, not that I'm usually inclined to be fair to her, she probably didn't say it exactly like that. And she wasn't the one who summoned the giant dimension-hopping snake during a live broadcast. My family sometimes charges into danger without thinking about it, but we're pretty good about not endangering civilians or blowing our cover. Given a choice between blowing her cover and letting a lot of civilians die, Verity had taken the only real option she had available. It was the one I would have taken, too, if I'd been in her place. But once her face was broadcast around the world, people saw her. People knew her. The Covenant was suddenly aware that our family was still alive, kicking and getting in the way of their undoubtedly nefarious plans for the world. That was a problem. The Covenant of St. George didn't become the biggest, baddest, monster-hunting organization the human race has ever known by standing back and letting their enemies do whatever they wanted to. They're killers. They were going to come for us. We needed to know how much they knew, and that's where I briefly digress from my digression about the Covenant of St. George to talk about monster hunter breeding programs. See, the Covenant has been a closed wall against the rest of the world for centuries. They take new recruits when they can get them, but the monster hunters of old did too good a job. They wiped out most of the dragons and ogres and giants and other really big, obvious, impossible-to-explain-away monsters that evolution had to offer. They also believed that a lot of those creatures drew their power from being believed in, so they spent centuries trying to convince everyone that sea serpents were logs and crossroads ghosts were just a trick of the light. The end result? A world where no one believes in monsters, and so nobody is really panting to sign up with a paramilitary monster-hunting organization. But they still need members, and like all good paramilitary organizations, they've been recruiting from the easiest available population, their own children. This is where I'd say something nasty about their parenting skills. Except for the part where my parents raised me the same way. I always knew I was going to go into the family business, because I always knew we lived in a dangerous, complicated world. One that needed me. Maybe that's the Covenant in us coming to the surface. Up until 5 generations ago, we were members in good standing, as bloodthirsty and obedient as the rest. We got better. The rest of the Covenant didn't. In order to avoid inbreeding and bad things, the Covenant started a genealogical branch right around the time they started having recruitment issues. Arranged marriages and predictable family traits became the name of the game. My family, my modern, American, non-Covenant family, looks a lot like a Covenant family called the Carews. Short and blonde and spunky and dangerous. Apparently, Carew genes are dominant, although Alex looks more like a Healy, taller and browner-haired and with slightly worse eyesight. Me, though? I actually look like a Price. And since my grandfather, Thomas Price, was the last Covenant member of his line, no one in the modern Covenant really knows what that means anymore. Out of all of us, I was the only one who could be sent to find out what the Covenant knew and what they were planning to do with that knowledge. I barely had time to tell my roller derby league I was going on sabbatical before my family had me on a plane to London, where I'd hooked up with the local Covenant recruitment center and had been whisked away to a big manor house in the middle of nowhere to be tested, evaluated, and eventually dropped into a shallow grave if they decided I wasn't what they were looking for. I have always done excellently on tests. I passed them all, despite the stress of pretending to be a zealot while concealing my honor guard of talking mice. And the Covenant decided I was a great recruit, deserving of a field trial. Which is how I wound up with the Spencer and Smith Family Carnival, having been sent undercover by the people I'd been sent undercover to spy on. And if that sentence feels like a headache waiting to happen, just imagine how I felt when all this was actually going on. The Covenant wanted me to assess the Spencer and Smith family carnival for a purge. There had been some disappearances. There had been some questions raised. If there was something killing people, the Covenant was ready to step in and make it stop. And the fact that they'd be doing it on North American soil, in territory my family had been struggling to protect for decades, was almost icing on the cake. They were testing my loyalty. They were testing my skills. They were backing the wrong horse. In a move that was predictable to anyone who'd ever met me without my masks on, I betrayed them, saved the people of the carnival, if not the carnival itself. We sort of burned that down. And then I got my mice to safety and ran, because they knew me. They had my blood, sweat, and skin, and if they were willing to bring their magic users to the party, they could track me down. I wasn't going to be the reason they found my family. The crowds at Lowry Land are big enough to confuse that sort of tracking spell. See, everyone in the world is technically related if you go far enough back along the family tree, and when you put a few thousand distant cousins in one place, the false positives are enough to overwhelm even the most focused magic. As long as I stayed where the people were, I would be safe. And as long as I had no contact with my family, I would be drawing no lines for the Covenant to follow. All it cost was my home, and my name, and everyone I cared about. No big deal, right? Right. Rubbing the back of my neck with one hand, like I could massage away all the aches and agonies of the day before they even happened, I left my room for the dubious comforts of the rest of my shared apartment. Lowry Land promised affordable housing to all their thousands of employees, in part, I assumed, so they could figure out how much of our paychecks we were socking away in preparation for heading someplace better. They didn't promise particularly comfortable housing, or that we wouldn't have to share it. Enter my roommates. Banes of my existence, the only reason I was still sane. And best of all, the reason the hall outside my room smelled strongly of bacon and coffee. Coffee, I moaned, shambling toward the kitchen. The door to the room shared by Megan and Fern was shut, which probably meant they had suffered another laundry tornado and didn't want to risk guests seeing inside. Not that we ever had any. Inviting guests over would have meant allowing other people to enter our home, and we had reasons to avoid that. Fern looked up when I appeared in the doorway. She was already beaming. "Morning, Annie," she chirped. "I made you extra bacon because I know you've got an extra shift tonight." "I love you. Don't call me Annie," I said, and made a beeline for the coffee machine. Reason number one, and the main source of any mental stability I currently have, Fern, a.k.a. the only person at Lowry Land who could blow my cover at any moment if she chose to, but who has blessedly chosen not to. A.k.a. one of the girls I used to skate with on the Slasher Chicks roller derby team back in Portland. A.k.a. one of the few close friends I've ever had who wasn't related to me, and thank God for that. Fern is a sylph, a humanoid cryptid capable of controlling her personal density. She's always short, skinny, and colored like a porcelain Bo Peep figure, all milky skin, golden hair, and vast blue eyes. It's just that sometimes she's light enough for a stiff breeze to carry away, literally, and other times she's denser than tungsten. Watching her deal with people trying to shove her out of the way on the train to work is one of my life's small joys. As to why she's in Florida instead of Portland, where I left her, I've yet to get a straight answer. And honestly, I don't much care. I know she's not reporting on me to the family. That's all I need to know. As for how I know, that's another story, and involves my dead Aunt Mary, who checks in on me weekly. I have a weird family. Without Fern, I wouldn't have survived my first week with the company. Without Fern, I definitely wouldn't be in one of the nicer apartments. And yes, our tiny, cabbage-scented place was considered one of the nicer options available. Fern had spotted me across the quad during housing registration for new hires, and had come bounding over to grab me by the elbow and announce me as her long-prophesized second roommate, awaited and adored. I'd been too surprised to fight, and she'd dragged me home with her, where I was given my own room and added to the lease. As for why I got my own room when I was the third person to come into the apartment, enter Exhibit B. Megan, short for Magera, because that's a name that modern people give to their children. Not that Megan's parents are modern. Megan's parents are Pliny's Gorgons, which makes Megan a Pliny's Gorgon, which means I couldn't room with her unless I wanted to be in constant danger of being temporarily paralyzed. Not my idea of a party. Fern didn't have the same concerns. Something about the way sylph density works, or doesn't, protects them from the gaze of the Gorgon. Just one more mystery of science that we may never have the opportunity or the equipment to solve. Currently, Megan was wigless, letting the snakes atop her head breathe freely. Their tongues constantly scented the air, assessing their environment. Like all Gorgon hair, they looked like perfectly ordinary serpents. If I ignored the fact that their bodies ended at a humanoid scalp instead of in a snaky tail, Gorgon x-rays are fascinating. They were colored like delicate rattlesnakes in shades of dark brown verging on black and the very palest of peach. They were beautiful, as was the woman they were attached to, who was sipping from a mug of coffee with her eyes half-lidded behind her smoked glasses. One of the snakes yawned, showing its fangs. Beautiful and dangerous. "How did you sleep?" asked Fern blithely. Of the three of us, she was the only morning person. Megan and I were united in our hatred of her before noon. We were united in loving her the rest of the time, so it worked out. "Not long enough," I said, splashing coffee into my cup. It was thick and black, brewed triple strength, just the way I liked it. Just the way all three of us liked it. "Word," muttered Megan. "What's your shift today?" I asked, dumping sugar into my coffee. The snakes on her head coiled into a striking position, responding to the change in her mood. "Noon to midnight," she said glumly. "I'm going to be such a corpse tomorrow." "Sucks," I agreed sympathetically. I was a general employee, going where I was told and filling whatever positions needed to be filled. I could work a register, monitor a gate, set up a parade route, or help guests get to where they were going. Fern, with her delicate build, perfect features, and already cartoon-worthy voice, was what we called a base character, one of the people who got to put on a fancy costume and spend the day embodying one of Lowry's cartoon creatures. In her case, Princess Aspen from Gold Tree and Silver Tree, that 1989 masterpiece of soft-focused pseudo-feminism in a fairy tale coating. The girl who played Elm was human and shared her apartment with two other face character performers and thought Fern was out of her mind for continuing to associate with riffraff like me. It takes all kinds to make a properly annoying world. Megan, on the other hand, was something elevated and rare, and wouldn't have been in general housing at all if she hadn't requested to be placed with Fern. Megan was a medical graduate student doing her residency at the Lowryland Hospital, which was, yes, a fully accredited and functional facility with the necessary equipment for everything from delivering a baby to performing organ transplants and other major surgical procedures. Getting a position there was supposed to be difficult, bordering on impossible, and no one could figure out how Megan had been able to get in, since she didn't come from an affluent family with a history of training on Lowry property. No one in her family tree was a millionaire, or possessed of much political capital, or even human. I would have been willing to bet she was the first cryptid ever to be accepted into the program. That was probably part of how she'd been able to get in. Gorgon communities like the one she comes from always need doctors. And so do the dragons, the Wadjet, and the other cryptids who look like mammals, but are really reptiles or therapsids. Once she qualified for Lowry, it would have been easy to hire someone like my Uncle Al to give her application the push it needed to rise to the top of the heap. As the only non-human in the program, though, she couldn't stay with the other residents without running the risk of blowing her cover and winding up in a biology lab. Hence her staying in the sticks with us, and dealing with the chaos of three competing schedules in one house. Three competing, Wait. Okay, why are we all up? I asked, lowering my mug. I'm supposed to be to work at 8. Did I oversleep again? I didn't look at the clock. If I was late, I was late, and nothing was going to change that. I was going to finish my coffee before I went off to get disciplined. My mom called this morning, said Megan. Her mother called at 4 o'clock, is what she means to say, said Fern. She doesn't understand that we can't be fully nocturnal here.
That, or she's punishing me for being a fussy baby.
Megan yawned, wider than a human would have been capable of yawning, until my own jaw ached in sympathy. I love my family, but I would swallow my own feet for a nap. So take one, I said. She shook her head.
Can't. If I sleep now, I'll sleep through the start of my shift.
Besides, if I'm up, I can give the two of you a ride to work. I perked up. Have I mentioned recently that you're a brilliant, talented doctor who's going to revolutionize the field of medicine? Megan's hair hissed at me. It's not that the train between employee housing and the park is unreliable. Like most things in Lowryland, it runs with a precision that would make a watchmaker weep. It's not that it's expensive. A monthly train pass is included with our employment and can be used to get on either at the employee parking lot or at any of the 6 housing stops. It's that the trains are always packed, and the air conditioning is broken about 2/3 of the time, and the upholstery smells like canned meat and old sweat, and there's no possible way to avoid people touching you whether they intend to or not. It's that there are cliques and social groups any place there are people, and being on the outside of the majority of them can make the ride pretty damned uncomfortable. To be fair to them, it's not like I've exactly gone out of my way to try making friends. To be unfair to them, it's not like they would have made it easy for me if I had. Most of them don't even like Fern, and she's the walking, talking incarnation of a happy meadow filled with butterflies and flowers. Amusement park politics are like academic politics, only more so. The infighting's so vicious because the stakes are so low. 10 minutes after Megan offered us a ride, Fern and I were dressed, within reason, and crammed into her battered Toyota Corolla. I had a purse full of bacon, makeup, and small personal items. Fern had an entire garment bag, which she used as a pillow as she stretched out across the back seat and closed her eyes. That was probably a large part of how she could survive being a morning person. The girl was capable of napping anywhere, even places where it should have been physically impossible to nap. "Our rear end's dragging," muttered Megan, before twisting around and jabbing Fern in the leg. "Hey, you! Lighten up!"
"Sorry, Megan," mumbled Fern sleepily.
The car's rear end rose 6 inches as she turned her personal density down, becoming about as substantial as her garment bag. Megan flashed me a wry, sidelong smile, a moment of camaraderie between unlikely roommates. I smiled back, more strained. At least I was trying. That was more than most people would have guessed I'd do. I was trying. I never wanted my life to be a wacky sitcom about a human girl and her inhuman roommate struggling to get by at what many people consider to be the second happiest place in the world. I'm not actually sure what I wanted my life to be. Figuring it out never seemed quite as important as living it. I'd been a cheerleader in high school and a roller derby player afterward. I'd taken my share of online courses, but I'd never bothered going to a real college. What was the point? The best I could do was get a degree I'd never use, since it's not like the Evergreen College in Olympia, Washington offers courses in how to be a better cryptozoologist. That might be unfair. Olympia is prime Bigfoot country, and if any school in the world is going to offer classes about them, it's going to be Evergreen. It's just that those classes would be vilely, violently wrong, and I'd probably have gotten myself expelled for punching a teacher. On the rare occasions when I'd tried to imagine where I saw myself in 10 years, it had either been on the track with my teammates, scoring points and skinning knees, or traveling with the Campbell side of the extended family, spending my days repairing rides and my nights slinging knives for the amusement of the paying audience. In a way, I guess I wanted what Verity wanted. I wanted a stage. I just wanted one that was smaller than hers, in warehouses and big tents rather than ballrooms, where no one remembered the performers,
only the performance. But I'd never seen myself isolated from my family. I didn't even have any mice with me. Whatever happened to me here, no one was going to witness or remember it. I was the first member of our family to be without a piece of our institutional memory since Elizabeth Matheson had discovered a colony of Aislinn mice worshipping a chicken in her yard. Aislinn mice, hyper-religious, hyper-loyal, and totally devoted to my family. Oh, and they talk. Standard protocol says that none of us go anywhere without a mouse, since that way if anything happens, the mouse might be able to make it back and tell the story. I'd started my journey with a mouse. Mindy, a member of my personal priesthood, had accompanied me to England to make sure that if something happened to me, word would get back to my family. We'd picked up another mouse there. Mork, a member of the colony that stayed behind when my great-great-grandparents quit the Covenant. He was the only English Aislinn I'd met. The rest preferred to stay in hiding, at least until their representative was able to come back and prove that our colony wasn't a bunch of mouse-eating monsters. It was clever. It was the right way to do things. The last time I'd seen either Mork or Mindy, I'd been in the process of leaving them with my maybe boyfriend, Sam, who'd promised to get them to the airport so that they could get back to the rest of my family. According to my dead Aunt Mary, they'd made it. They were fine. That was probably the only reason my mother wasn't burning the world down to find me. Being the youngest child in my family has sometimes meant feeling like an afterthought. The kid conceived to be a blood donor to the two that actually mattered. But even when I'd been feeling like that, I never questioned whether my parents loved me or whether they would charge into the gates of hell to snatch me back if they thought they could get away with it. That was one more reason I needed to stay in hiding. If they knew where to find me, they would come to bring me home, and then... Most tracking spells work better when there's no interference around the person who's being tracked. My family lives in a survivalist compound outside of Portland. We've always used isolation as one of our greatest strengths. Put me in the building, and it could become an even greater weakness. Context is everything. The traffic was heavy around us. Cars packed with tourists heading for Lowryland, mingling with cars packed with employees heading for Lowryland. Part of why Fern liked to stretch out in the back seat when we got a ride to work was the crowd. When we went bumper to bumper, not an everyday occurrence, but not as rare as I'd like either, people got bored and peered into the cars around them, looking for a karaoke show or a nose picker or an interesting dog. Even out of costume, there was a chance Fern would be recognized. Annual pass holders were notorious for learning to identify individual performers, and they could cause problems when encountered off the clock. The scariest incident we'd had so far had been at the Target, of all places. Fern and I had been looking at canned goods when a hand clamped down on her arm and someone started dragging her away, pulling her several feet before she'd managed to increase her density to the point where she couldn't be moved anymore. And then I'd punched the asshole in the gut. He'd fallen over, threatening to call store security and to notify Lowryland about a misbehaving princess. We'd run. When Fern made her security report, she had left me out, claiming that the puncher was a helpful stranger, and since it hadn't happened on park property, it hadn't been pursued. But we'd been a lot more careful since then, and we always went shopping in a group. The employee turnoff loomed up ahead. Megan tightened her hands on the wheel, an involuntary gesture that broadcast, loudly, how much she didn't want to take it. "I could keep driving," she said, voice light and sincere. "We could head for the coast, just the three of us, surf, sand, unemployment," I said. "I need this job. You need your residency." "I need a bathroom," said Fern. "Fern needs a bathroom," I said. "Sad but true. We have to go to work." "Spoil sport," said Megan, and made the turn. The traffic was lighter here. Most Lowryland employees take the train, and the rest of us tend to carpool. Since the parking lot is a nightmare wasteland where people have come to blows over the good spots. Megan wasn't parking. She pulled up to the employee drop-off point, where a line had already formed of cast members waiting for the bus that would take them to the backstage entrance to the park. Let the magic begin, I muttered, and opened the door. See you tonight?
Sweet Medusa, I hope not, said Megan. You need to sleep, or you're going to wind up stabbing somebody.
Only if they deserve it, I said. Megan was laughing as I closed the door. Fern and I turned to